Welcome to VMN Volume 3, Episode 15. The date is July 11th, 2023. VMN is produced and transmitted from unceded Abenaki territory of so-called Vermont. Today we will be speaking with Alexander Reed Ross about the upcoming Fake Peace Rally on August 6th at the UN. Alexander Reed Ross is well known for his analysis of the Red-Brown Alliance, where the far right makes common cause with elements of the left. I became aware of this rally when a supporter of Matt Heimbach's Patriotic Socialist Front advertised the rally in a Vermont right-wing Republican Facebook thread. Welcome, Alexander.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, there have been a disparate set of people at these rallies, people like Jimmy Dore. I'm not sure if Denis Kucinich is endorsing this particular rally, but he's been involved in that. And then we have Nazi leader Matt Heimbach, Tulsi Gabbard at these rallies. What brings these people together?
That's a great question. I think that foremost, the thing that they rebel against is this idea that they have of a kind of a liberal, institutionalist, and capitalist mainstream against which they're trying to compile as many willing forces as possible, because in their minds, you can't be selective about coalition building. It has to include everybody to undermine what they view as the sort of imperialist core. And that imperialist core for them does not come from the far right of the United States. It comes from, again, the mainstream.
Gotcha. So this seems a lot like, I originally come from a Marxist background, though I'm more of an anarchist these days. I used to hear a lot of comparisons between like the People's Front and a United Front, as the People's Front is these unprincipled alliances. Does that strike any notes with you?
I tend to find that, you know, that the terminology between United Front and Popular Front tends to be very, confused at times. You get a lot of people initially saying the United Front is the Leninist approach, which is led by the proletariat, but the Popular Front is the Stalinist approach that incorporates elements of the bourgeoisie and tries to centrally control it from more of like a directorate kind of position. But I don't think that those categories necessarily hold once you look past the sort of 1935-1936 models of the Popular Front that emerged with Léon Blum's France and, of course, the Spanish Republic, because you end up with a lot of different kind of terms going around for national liberation movements and anti-colonial movements, which often use terms more fluidly for the Popular Front or the United Front and so on and so forth. So I agree with you that you often do see these kinds of sectarian indexes, you know, emerging, which themselves end up needing whole glossaries to unpack. But by that very kind of nature, it becomes infinitely complex, and all these terms sort of wind their way through the libraries of Babel.
How would you describe these what we're seeing now with these type of rallies and alliances going on?
It's a popular united front of the... No, I'm kidding. It's okay, so let's use the terms that they'll kind of put forward, right? Like an anti-imperialist alliance, maybe, or let's say a populist movement, right? Like the one group that's associated with these types of rallies is the People's Party or Movement for a People's Party. I'm not sure if they've made it all the way to the People's Party yet. But anyway, so they kind of openly put forward this sort of ideal initial platform of the People's Party, right? This kind of idea that left and right are useless categories now, and the only real category is the people versus the elites. And this is very tempting, and it's obviously something that has been very popular on the left as the sort of primary position, like with the we're the 99%, right? The whole platform of Occupy Wall Street was very similar in the sense of we need to get over our political differences. Nobody's a racist anymore. Sexism is a thing of the past. You know, we have to understand that we're all in it together against the 1%. Even the police are part of the 99%, et cetera, et cetera. Very generalist kind of ideas. And it worked at that time, interestingly enough, because Obama was in power. The far right was, you know, smaller in 2011. You still had the Tea Party and stuff like that. And you had efforts by the Tea Party to kind of involve themselves in Occupy to some degree, but generally it was agreed in Occupy circles that no, we will not allow Tea Party groups to come in and actually like take over and have kind of controlling say here. They won't really be equal partners if they'll be allowed at all. So there were libertarians, Ron Paul libertarians, that kind of thing, who kind of moved in and out of Occupy and made themselves a presence to some degree or another. There were LaRoucheites doing the same thing. But generally speaking, the movement behind Occupy Wall Street was really a social justice activist movement with the strong ecological backing as well. After Trump got in power, those sorts of ideas became part of a pro-Trump sovereignty movement, which would see people like Max Blumenthal going on Tucker Carlson and talking about, and Matt Taibbi obviously played a big role in this, sort of continuing this idea of it's the people versus the elites, right? But always interestingly excising Trump from the category of elites and putting him in the process of the popular movement. So Trump now represented the people, the 99% somehow, as opposed to the 1%, because he would give these sorts of bromides and populist diatribes. And so you saw really with the Trump campaign, this movement and presidency, this movement to co-opt the populist sort of verve of Occupy and of the social movements leading up to the 2015-2016 and turn it toward the populist radical right. And so there was a momentum that partly was diverted into the Trump movement, unfortunately, from these sorts of left-wing traditions. And Russian media obviously played a role in this because it platformed left-wingers who felt cut out from United States media and gave them a gloss, gave them a sense of being professionals, and really highlighted their populist opinions, which then again fed back into the Trump movement. And so in this interesting phase of like post-Trump America with a sort of a liberal restoration slogging its way through the mire of modern sort of popular unrest, you have this almost nostalgic populism that looks to the Trump era in a sense as a missed opportunity or even a lost cause. And they are producing these sort of subcurrents, maybe little eddies within the general, if you will, the masses or mass culture, to try and develop a kind of a hegemony, for a kind of, I don't know, maybe you would call it sort of a, as a, in terms of social composition, like an Occupy 2.0 that is far less anchored by the kind of social justice activism that we saw in 2011, right? Which was always talking about things like white privilege, which was always talking about LGBTQ plus rights, and was always talking about ecology and stuff like that. And moving those moorings over into this kind of more opaque and blurry populist sentiment, which is a little bit more class reductionist, oddly, and also more foreign policy oriented. And that's where you're getting into the peace movement type of stuff, where it seems now that resistance against liberalism in the United States, liberal democracy in the United States, is the best opportunity for it is on the terrain of foreign policy, specific with Ukraine. And of course, you have had anti-imperialist movements since the 1970s positioning their domestic politics on the terrain of international relations, right? With Palestine, with Libya, Nicaragua, and so forth. And now you kind of see that resurgence as effectively they kind of lost on the domestic level. I don't know. I don't know if I actually even answered that question. I'm so sorry. That was so rambling and terrible.
That's fine. I mean, we're just trying to get a background of where these rallies come from. Can you talk a little bit about the phenomenon of MAGA communism? How did this come about? And maybe that can seg into CPI and some of these awful groupings.
Sure, sure. So yeah, because it's sort of the same people, if I'm not mistaken. People like Caleb Maupin and Jackson Hinkle. These are, I guess we can just talk about these two guys as kind of social leaders in a sense, coming from different backgrounds. So Caleb Maupin comes out of the, if I'm not mistaken, the Workers' World Party of New York City, right? I was actually there. I lived there for a little while. I think I might have met him once. I was friends with one of his close friends while I lived in New York. And we ran in some of the same circles, because obviously I'm a leftist too, but you know, you can't help rub elbows in some places with tankies or what have you, you know, in a broad tent. And this is before Occupy. And so he comes out of a milieu that was already very connected, let's say, to international tanky communities. And by tanky, I'm referring to authoritarian left-wingers, people who celebrate the legacies of Mao and Stalin and the crushing of the Hungarian Revolution of 56 and various other efforts to cast off the yoke of Moscow's imperialism during the Soviet era. And so these guys tend to deny the Bosnian genocide, you know, taking the side of the Serbian ultranationalists in the 90s. And it kind of goes down the list from there, you know, very pro-Putin. Although they will say, no, we're not pro-Putin. We just see Russia as a counter-hegemony to the United States' international imperialism or something like that. In truth, though, they follow down the Russian agenda internationally. For example, if not openly supporting Bashar al-Assad, denying that the dictator of Syria used chemical weapons against his own people, which has been proven all over the place. This kind of of international sort of movement, supportive of Assad, supportive of Putin, also supportive of the theocracy in Iran, views itself as part of an international axis of resistance, also including, say, Hezbollah, Ukraine, right? They follow the Putinist position. Ukraine is a Nazi state that needs to be destroyed because in the first place, it's not even a state. It's not even a country. Ukrainians don't exist, basically. They're just sort of rural Russians who speak a weird dialect. So, of course, is not true. You know, Ukrainians as a people have existed for a long time. They speak their own language, et cetera, et cetera. If anything, Russia was initially based in Ukraine. And so Ukraine should have the rest of Russia, maybe. No, just kidding. This is a sort of a tanky apparatus, the Workers' World Party, which then spun a front group called the Answer Coalition, which then spun its own new party called the Party for Socialism and Liberation. They are always, you know, trying to enter into movements and sort of co-opt them or develop new front groups in order to see if they can kind of get standing in some social sectors or movements and so forth. So that's kind of a longer tradition dating back to the 50s. And then you've got Jackson Hinkle, who comes out of California, Orange County, if I'm not mistaken, and also comes out of the Bernie Sanders movement. So a little bit more recent. And it seems that he just sort of like incrementally discovered that the more waves he could make, the sort of more followers he would get. And so just sort of went into controversialism. Maybe he didn't feel like he was getting enough attention from the libs and felt a lot of Bernie supporters felt really resentful about how the campaign went down in 2015, 2016. And so he kind of moved into this sort of mode of supporting like patriotism from the left, and from there sort of developing this kind of like, I'm a patriotic socialist, which always actually has grounding in a much longer tradition of fascist movement building. So if you look at, for example, the Russian fascist Alexander Dugin, who's played a role in Russia's transnational efforts to influence elections and support the radical right, what Dugin will say is that the patriotic socialists are an important sort of gear in the apparatus of anti-liberalism through which a new kind of fascist era will emerge. And so, yeah, this idea of patriotic socialism has a sort of a backing. It has form, if you will, in the fascist movement internationally. Not clear whether or not Hinkle himself is aware of that. It seems he may be. I believe he's made some statements about Dugin in the past. Caleb Maupin, who I mentioned earlier, has actually been on a panel with Dugin in Moscow and has said nice things about Dugin as well. Another thing that Dugin does is he says, oh, I'm not actually a fascist. I'm not anything. I'm just a populist, right? So he'll couch all of his theories and ideologies in this sort of vague position of being a populist. Whereas he'll also fully openly admit that he supports national Bolshevism, national socialism, Nazism, fascism in a Russian form. So he's kind of not very clever in that sense. But so this patriotic socialism steered its way around towards supporting Trump from the left because they view liberalism as a very corrupting influence that's, you know, eroding kind of the values that make America great. And so they'll put forward a mixture of left and right that heavily favors Putin's Russia, if not as a model of governance, as a counterpower to the United States.
I'm located in Vermont, and you actually, if you look at barns around here, you'll see this You'll see Bernie Sanders signs all over a barn and then a Trump sign. It's yep. kind of mind-boggling to see it. And one of the nastiest Vermont politicians is named John Klar. He's taken extreme right positions, and he loves to pick on trans people. And my understanding is he started out as a Bernie supporter and then decided he wanted to enter politics as a Republican. And he's mm-hmm. written this book called Small Farm Republic, which is, mm-hmm. I think you're going to get the gist of where he's, I got where the he's gist going. Already.
Exactly. Yep. Absolutely. And it's a very common thing. Obviously fascism itself is a weird kind of ideological deviation, a right-wing deviation from the left in an interesting way. Mussolini had been a socialist, a very hardcore revolutionary socialist, and the editor of the Socialist Party's, you know, newspaper, Avanti, before he got into it with some of the other Socialist Party leaders. He obviously had big aspirations, and Cerretti, I think his name was Cerretti, was standing in his way. He got like really mixed up in a lot of physical disputes with other socialists. And when World War I started to pop off, he received funding from industry and from the French to try and turn the socialists towards a war position. And his newspaper for that, Popolo d'Italia, something like that, was a complete right-wing turn, although it used a lot of the language and rhetoric of the socialist movement, because he was well-versed, he was creating that. So he was able to draw a lot of socialists to the right through his sort of warmongering. And after the war, he continued to get funding and build this right-wing anti-socialist movement. And he would say, like, you know, we're not right-wing, we're just anti-socialist, before he moved towards a very clear right-wing position. So very open and clear right-wing position. So you hear people like say that fascism is liberalism, you know, liberals are the true fascists, and or fascism is actually a left-wing ideology. All that stuff is not true. That is all false. But what is true is that this sort of weird kind of channel for leftists to move right is very available and taken by a lot of people who get very frustrated with, oftentimes very frustrated with, the left's inability to actually take power through revolutionary efforts. So you have this disillusionment. It's not even necessarily the pro-war position of Mussolini that brings him to fascism as such. It's more of the opportunity that gives him to express his views, you know, in 1914, and then again especially 1919, 1920, that the big socialist movements and the big socialist uprisings had failed because the left lacked discipline and the capacity for violence, right? Because if you look at England, for example, obviously, the fascists had a very anti-war position. If you look to the United States during World War II, obviously, the fascists had a very anti-war position, because they did not want the United States or England to get involved in a war against the Nazis and against the Italian fascists, right? So it's not like a pro-war position brings you into fascism. It's more like fascists will take whatever opportunities available in foreign policy to support their own interests. And, you know, I'm saying that as somebody who's not pro-war at all, but recognizes in Ukraine, for example, that the war was brought by Russia. So it's pro-war to support the Russian position here. It's not pro-war to support Ukraine's defense against the war that was brought to them. To summarize the main point that I'm trying to kind of hit on, albeit, you know, really poorly, is basically that left-wingers who are disenfranchised with their inability to gain a following by sticking with the general consensus of the left, or who find it more opportune to move towards a kind of more elitist position, tend to move rightward. And that's where you often find fascism, not from the more staid traditional conservative groups, but from the sort of upstarts who become highly ideological and become driven by a kind of extreme opportunism.
What risk do you think there is of well-meaning progressives to being pulled into this, the orbit of, on this particular issue?
I go back and forth because I just have been very disillusioned in the past few years at the extent to which leftists can really independently assess social conditions without leader worship and celebrity worship and even electoralism. Even though I would say, and I constantly say, that electoralism, that voting is harm reduction, basically. Which wasn't always my position. I didn't vote for a long, long time, but I feel like maybe I don't know. I've grown up a little. But yeah, even electoralism, I find like very, very disconcerting when people really put their heart and souls into believing that they're going to, you know, really change things through electoralism. I'm like, I don't know. It's just a lot of effort that they're expending in a kind of political apparatus that is not well disposed to change, when there's a lot of other ways that you can try to make change happen more directly, maybe more effectively. And electoralism tends to draw people towards a patriarchal kind of structure, leader principle and that sort of thing. And then people who gain that kind of authority and that kind of leadership, that kind of responsibility, they often mess up. They often get tempted to increase their power. And that can often lead to associations and connections and sympathies with other people who similarly use their power to accrue more power. I think that we have a lot of dangers among progressives, especially to understand and assess conspiracy theories and anti-Semitism, and the ability to, you know, because those capacities are directly tied to independent critical thinking. And, you know, I feel like, from what I've seen, it's not looking great in those capacities. But I guess, I don't know. So to basically kind of bring that all around, I don't look to progressives for hope, you know? I'm generally, these days, kind of more open to trying to escape ideological systems and engage with people I know, people who I meet, and directly with just ordinary people, and understanding kind of social systems as they exist outside of political clustering. Unfortunately, it seems like the country is increasingly polarized and increasingly clustered politically. And I say unfortunately because I don't think that that is, at the end of the day, really helping things It's a huge danger, in short, for progressives. And there doesn't seem to be any kind of nostrums that I can give that would make it better.
Let's get down to a little bit of tax on the people who were in this August 6th rally. Can you explain to listeners what the LaRouche organization and its Schiller Institute are?
So the LaRouche organization, LaRouche comes out of that kind of direct tanky split, in a sense, because he was part of the Socialist Workers Party, and he split away from them in the 50s. Lyndon LaRouche, retaining this sort of like apparent sort of aberrant Trotskyist approach, like a framework. And he quickly found that other people on the left wouldn't really fall into his sort of bracketed Trotskyite tendency. And he turned very violent against them. He had something called the Operation Mop-Up that he put into action in the 70s, I think it was, where they would violently assault and harass other left-wing groups, like the Communist Party. Like at one point, there was I think it was at a church, there was this communist gathering, and his acolytes broke in with literal nunchucks and just started like wailing on people. Really weird time, 1970s. I don't even understand. But so they would do that. He became also obsessed with mind control. And he would like try to hypnotize his followers, some of his followers. So there was weird cult stuff going on, even in the 70s. And he also entertained alliances with Nazis. I think it was, is it Miles? I think it was Miles, like a Klan leader and posse comitatus guy, you know, violent Nazi, who LaRouche sort of entertained this correspondence with. And in the 80s, they started to do this sort of intelligence review where they tried to develop this quasi anti-imperialist framework, which some people said was maybe like, I don't know. There's a lot murky going on with what LaRouche was doing in the 80s. And he had this whole conceptual labyrinth that he worked out that like the British monarchy was controlling global Zionism and the drug trade. So he got this really anti-Semitic kind of prismatic ideological construct together, highly conspiratorial, and ultimately was convicted and, if I'm not mistaken, thrown in jail for fraud.
And yeah, three years for fraud.
3 years in jail for fraud. And when he got out, he kind of insinuated himself into Russian and Chinese planning apparatuses, more specifically like the neo-Eurasianists tied to Sergei Glazyev in Russia, who put forward the sort of like the most kind of fundamental red-brown kind of idea, like very anti-Semitic, very anti-Zionist, and like really using that as a sort of linchpin to unite the right ultra-nationalists and sort of the hardcore authoritarian Stalinists, which is not as difficult as you might think, because Stalin himself The Soviets actually literally conscripted imperial geographers, like czarist geographers, in order to develop their ethno-state divisions in like Dagestan and all that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of like this kind of imperialist empire building, let's call it empire building, during the early decades of the Soviet Union and further beyond that too. But so anyway, LaRouche, yeah, gets involved in that sort of thing. He gets involved in some Chinese state planner kind of circles. And his big thing is like, or was like, giant infrastructure projects. So like the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, which is, or the New Silk Road, that kind of stuff. Or like building a massive bridge from Russia to Alaska, right? Those kinds of ideas, very kind of LaRouche. Sort of because he didn't believe that there were any limits to growth. In his view, you know, anybody who said anything about, you know, population and stuff like that was insane, which it's correct to say that the fear-mongering about the global population, especially of the global South in the 1970s and 1980s, all the stuff about carrying capacity, that was racist and tied to white nationalist positions. But the idea that there's no limits to growth at all has led LaRouche's followers to completely deny climate change, or to say maybe it's a good thing, to say that people who say climate change is a big problem are like Nazis or something like that. So yeah, they're really weird conspiracy theorists, far right wing, and heavily syncretic as well. So like, I say far right wing because, you know, they're not exactly egalitarians, but also, at least not as far as I can understand the term egalitarian, but also their conspiracy theorism and their roots in the Trotsky movement kind of help them adapt these right-wing ideas into left-wing kind of positions to some degree. Not unlike, you know, how the Iranian theocracy is able to appeal to anti-imperialists. You know, obviously Iran is not a left-wing state, and yet they're defended by some apparently left-wing ideologues because of their purported anti-imperialism, because the way that they're able to adapt their political reactionary positions to global frameworks.
So like the New Horizons Conference?
New Horizons Conference, that's a really interesting one. That's, I'm trying to remember the name of the, it's like Talibade or something like that. The name of the guy who runs New Horizons. It's an Iranian kind of media gloss. It's a conference that takes place in Iran, or now it's sometimes it's in like Lebanon or whatever, but it's basically run by Iranian intelligence as a place where they can like flip agents, and as a place where they can like draw in interested parties from the West and kind of network them in a generally kind of anti-liberal movement. And I mean, there's a lot of vulnerability on the left to that sort of operation, because in many ways leftism can become seriously anti-liberal, especially in the United States, where, let's say, from Nixon to Obama, the far right was really kind of alienated from mainstream politics. And I don't mean like including Nixon. I mean Nixon as the sort of the last far right politician, but in the office of the presidency. But yeah, so you have the far right positioning themselves in the 80s against Ronald Reagan. You have this sort of idea of the far right as being excluded, and this idea of there being a cordon sanitaire that kind of cut out the far right from US politics. And so when the left sees the far right as being alienated from politics, it gives this impression that the main enemy is no longer Nazis, it's no longer the Klan, because those groups don't have any power, they don't have any teeth, they don't have any claws, you know, they're defanged. The real enemy are the liberals who control the media and who control the universities and who control the this, that, and the other, education and all that kind of stuff. So what the left has to do is it has to target liberal apparatuses. And if it sneakily wants to kind of join forces with the far right in anti-war movements and that sort of thing, then that's fair game. And that's exactly what we saw during the Iraq War. Funny enough, a lot of people don't really know this. I didn't know this until I really started researching it. But, you know, there was some crossover between like the paleoconservatives, you know, Pat Buchanan, people who had been party to the Nixon administration, and then after that really cut out by the neoconservatives. So a lot of overlap between those guys, Ron Paul, Pat Buchanan, Paul Gottfried, and some anti-imperialists in the left, like Alexander Coburn, for example. So the crossover is not new, but I think with Occupy Wall Street, the rise of left-wing social movements during the Obama administration, precisely when it seemed like there was no alternative to liberalism, that liberalism was so ubiquitous as to be the only power in the United States, that kind of crossover became more normal. And then in a way helped to facilitate the rise of Trump, as populists kind of put forward this notion that Hillary would be worse than Trump. And if you didn't believe that, or if you thought that the Russians were at play here, then you were a McCarthyite. So yeah, again, that brings us kind of full circle to this reality that we're living in today, where we still have this kind of dissident group on the left, or ostensibly on the left, that is still trying to shake hands and partner up with the far right to oppose and destroy liberalism. But now it seems like their perspective is, in hindsight, very lacking after 4 years of Trump, and with this kind of meteoric rise of the anti-Semitic and authoritarian far right. It no longer appears that liberalism is unchallenged at the top of the world. So their strategy no longer seems to be effective to anybody on the left. Let's say their strategy no longer appears pragmatic and now appears far more ideologically driven.
Another one of the participants of this upcoming rally is the Black Hammer organization. Digging into them, they're a split off from the African People's Socialist Party that went far right. Can you discuss them a little bit?
Oh, so they are, yeah, I don't know why they're involved in anything public. And you do not have to hand it to them, but it's interesting that they have held on. I think most people with a conscience would dissolve immediately after what happened regarding their leader, who I won't name, but who I think is now in prison for raping one of their members and threatening to kill that person. They also have been indicted by the United States for participating in Russian influence operations. I believe that they took money to fly across the country and protest outside of Meta's headquarters in opposition to the quashing of free speech or something of that nature.
Was that Black Hammer or African People's Socialist Party too?
It was both of them.
Okay, both of them were involved.
So there were two unnamed groups, and I think Twitter detectives tracked down that it was Black Hammer and this other organization that you name. So they have a very grotesque record, and it's quite shocking to see anybody kind of try to drag them back up to the podium after what's taken place. But they also had a public get together, I think it was with Gavin McInnes, where they kind of put forward this general platform that you also see with Brenna from the People's Party of Proud Boys should get together with anti-racists and basically pose the real threat to the system, capital S, right? Again, it's the general populist position, bringing the margins all together to oppose the big bad guy.
So to make it even worse, I was investigating the People's Socialist Front, Matt Heimbach's new project. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Matt Heimbach, who was one of the organizers of the Unite the Right rally, and they were having a discussion of organizing alongside with Black Hammer.
Sure. Yeah. So Heimbach is a white nationalist. He was one of the best among the alt-right at translating their theories in terms that evoked a kind of a workers' resentment against the bosses. You know, he had that kind of like West Virginia Appalachian appeal that came off really well in the media. And then I forget what happened. I think it was his partner in that organization caught him copulating with the guy's wife, who was incidentally also his mother-in-law. I don't remember exactly how it worked, but it was really kind of interesting. And
the night of the wrong wives.
Yeah, the night of the wrong wives, as it's called. And he's also, Heimbach is another guy who's always been drawn to Russian far right movements as well, and Eastern European far right movements in general. Like his group would wear the Kodriano shirts referencing the Hungarian. I think it's no. Is it Romanian? I think Romania. It's Romanian.
Romanian.
Yeah. It's Romanian. The Legion of the Archangel Michael. Good God, it's been a while since I went back into this this rabbit hole. And so he brought over the, it sounds like you know more than I do about this, but he brought over the Russian Imperial Movement representative to hang out in the United States, and also has sort of been involved in this sort of Dugin network of, you know, and is now obviously, you know, fully endorsing and embracing this like patriotic socialism idea. My friend Shane Burley did a really great article where he really kind of like investigates Heimbach's claims, because Heimbach said that he kind of like tried to do this comeback where he like said he's abandoned fascism and he's now a leftist. And so he like tried to do this circuit of like proselytes who have left the far right and now can like go on speaking tours and talk about how Antifa is the real problem, and that Antifa is what's behind the germination of the far right. But his claims don't really hold up under scrutiny, as Shane found through extensive interviews with Heimbach himself. Really like what Heimbach is putting forward is just this sort of, it's kind of like a distilled fascism that is watered down for popular consumption. But when you really get to what he's talking about, his politics really haven't changed. And this idea of like, we need white nationalists, we need black nationalists, we need all of the kind of like different identitarian groups to join together in a mass opposition is something that fascists have been saying for quite a while, because they find that ethnocentrism is ethnocentrism. And so anybody who's ethnocentric is a supremacist, but by nature of that, they can understand one another much better. And if they can work together, then they become more powerful. And so the idea is we'll just put off what's going to happen until after the revolution or whatever. Of course, that never works. But
one thing in my looking into this stuff with the Patriotic Socialist Front, I'm not going to name names because we're still investigating, but I can give you this tidbit. There was an individual who posted that he was working with the Patriotic Socialist Front and the Schiller Institute at the same time.
Oh,
can you say anything about that?
So he's working with Heimbach and with the LaRouches? Yeah. Well, I mean, birds of a feather. I mean, again, like the LaRouches have been, you know, working with fascists and courting Nazis for quite a while. So it shouldn't come as any surprise that they would be working together. The again, the Russian sort of sect that the LaRouches are the closest to are the Neo-Eurasianists, who are the most fascist. I mean, well, maybe let's not say the most fascist sect of Russia, but certainly we could say one of the most influential fascist sects in Russia, very plugged into the SVR and whatnot.
What was that plugged into the
SVR, the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service? Yeah. So there it is.
Excellent. So before we wrap this up, how do you think people on the left can best oppose this rally on August 6th? Because the reason I had you on is I want to push back on this nonsense as much as I can.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess staying safe is my biggest piece of advice. You know, use good security culture. If you feel comfortable speaking out against it, I mean, I don't think that can hurt. As far as like strategy is concerned, I mean, that obviously is going to entail a much broader discussion than I can kind of put out there at this time, you know. These types of people are just one of the many, many, many kind of nuclei that I kind of try to keep an eye on. And I think that they're useful to keep an eye on, not because they really pose that big of a physical or imminent of a physical threat. You know, they're not like active clubs who it's like, okay, I can see how they're gonna like kill a journalist or so at some point or something like that, right? Like that requires a higher degree of care. But you know, when they're getting like Heimbach in their group and stuff like that, it's also like, how extensive are their networks, you know, and what are they really doing? So there can be protests, but I would recommend to keep them light, speaking out, especially among other progressives and other leftists, you know, because that is what I was going to say. That's their kind of their biggest threat, is to continually derail left-wing movements and to shift focus from social justice, from keeping each other safe, from solidarity, from intersectionality, to like Ukraine is like gay Nazis who are coming for your debt relief or something like that. Like, you know, like they're derailing what our movements should be focusing and concentrating on and turning them toward these conspiracy theories that end up just benefiting their own hierarchies, which I mean, if you look at people like Jimmy Dore, who lives in this like million-dollar mansion in Los Angeles, these are authoritarian organizations with very vertical hierarchies, you know, comprising real elitists who, you know, don't really like grassroots movements. Even though they call themselves populists, you can look at Trump as a prime example of a modern populist, or Elon Musk. But I'll stop there because I don't want to talk about Elon Musk today. My lawyers are too tired.
So before we sign off for the day, is there anything you want to promote or plug?
If I have an opportunity, I'd say like some groups that are cool, that are not like that, and that... that I put more faith in are like political research associates. You know, they're a really cool group that researches and investigates the far right and tries to help local communities, you know, create bonds of solidarity. Also, the Western State Center are really cool. They do a lot of great work around pride and anti-Semitism. They all do, right? Anti-Semitism and stuff like that. And I don't know. Yeah. Go Blazers. Portland Blazers. We're going to need it this year.
Well, thank you very much. This has been Alexander Reed Ross. This was for VMN Volume 3, Episode 15. VMN was formerly known as Vermont Movement News and can be found on podcast apps as Vermont Movement News. Thank you very much, Alexander.
Thank you, Marina.